Welcome back, everyone. I'm Cass Pianci, and I am here, as usual, with my partner in crime, Bennett Tomlin. How are you?
I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm good. Today, we're joined by another special guest, Robert Green, a marketing consultant who has worked with the likes of AOL, Condé Nast, Fox Studios, Amex, and Bank of America. It is wonderful to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I've been enjoying this wild ride the past couple weeks.
Yes, and it has been a wild one. Let's start out with how you got involved in this space and whenabouts that was.
Sure. So right around the end of 2017, I, like a lot of other people, became more interested in crypto because there was an explosion of ICOs and it seemed really interesting to me intellectually and potentially from an equity perspective. It seemed like maybe this was a more fair way to raise money. Kind of put my name out there and my company at the time, which was called Creator Ripple. We were working in VR, in traditional content, animation, design, websites, etc. And I was approached by a guy named Sean McDonald, who confusingly for a guy named Sean McDonald seemed to have an Israeli accent. I would set that aside, which in retrospect, I wish I had not. But anyway, he approached me and said, hey, I've heard you're the best marketing guy in New York. And I, like anyone, like a nice ego stroke. So I was like, yes, that is true. I am, in fact, the best marketing guy in New York. He said, great. My company, BCT, has just raised all this money and we need to get out to market. We need to talk to, amongst other people, institutional investors and day traders. And I said, great. I've done a lot of that. I've worked in fintech. I've worked in finance. I know a lot of those people. This sounds great. I gave him a price quote. He said, and I said, I can give you a quarter of my company's time for that money. He said, well, I'm going to quadruple that money. So I need you to work more. Me being the same greedy person as the rest of us was like, sounds great, man. Let's do it. So starting in January of 2018, I started working with what was called BCT, BCT Blockchain Terminal. The idea, which seemed like a really good idea to me, was to create a Bloomberg terminal for crypto. And to have the same kind of information flow for those of you, and I assume everyone in your audience knows what the Bloomberg Terminal is, but if you don't, it's a subscription service, and it's also a physical screen that traders use that used to give them a real arbitrage on information. It's not as important anymore, but it still is a thing that people pay a lot of money for, and it's how Michael Bloomberg is so damn rich. One of the reasons I got involved in BCT was not because there were some random blockchain people I had never heard of, but because there was a CEO who came from AllianceBernstein, who was a very serious guy, a guy named Bob Bonomo, had been the chief information officer over at Bernstein. And, you know, that's half a trillion dollars assets under management. It's a very serious company. And there was a relationship with FactSet, which is the number two to Bloomberg Terminal in terms of trading information and what traders use. FactSet is a really serious company. So I thought, wow, if they've got FactSet on board, they have the serious CEO, this sounds great. And I dived in with both feet. The first month, it turned out that what I was actually doing was creating a sort of logistical flowchart for how these guys could actually do all the things they needed to do, which included going to and having presence at every conference in the world. And for those of you who don't remember, in 2017, 2018, the conferences were thick. But if you were going to a conference, you needed stand-ups, you needed logos, you needed business cards, you needed content, you needed a presentation that was on a screen, you needed an explainer video. So day two was, okay, guys, here are all the things you need. My company can do all of these things. Plus, I brought in a friend of mine who does logistics. He started setting up accounts for them to be able to travel because, and again, in retrospect, perhaps a red flag, they didn't actually have an American bank. They couldn't actually travel exactly appropriately. And they asked if they could put all of this on my credit card, which who doesn't like extra free miles on their credit card? So I said yes to that. And I did try to create a banking relationship for them. It was not easy because they were a crypto company and most of the banks that I talked to didn't want to get involved. Also, I should add parenthetically, they had Sullivan Cromwell as their lawyers. And for those of you who don't know, Sullivan Cromwell, old school, serious law firm. My first week there was they asked me to build their website and they asked me to do one thing in particular, which really, really was on the continuing series of red flags, the reddest of them all. They asked me to put Brock Pierce and his name on their website as an advisor. Now, I am Web 1.0. I remember Den in 1999 because I raised $35 million for Web 1.0 content company myself. I went to Den. I met Brock. I met his partners. They were gross. They were bad people. They were doing terrible things, allegedly involving young boys. Allegedly. So I said to my BCT folk, I'm not putting that guy on your website as an advisor. Also, I'm noticing some of these other advisors like Miko Matsumura and all these other guys are advisors to like 1,000 companies. Like, are they actually doing anything for all of this advising they seem to be doing? It seems a little bit insane. Also, I was introduced at that point to a company called DNA. DNA was really trying to make itself be the core company at the heart of all the ICOs. They had been founded by, it turned out later I would discover, a guy named Brock Pierce. So I had all these different moving parts. I was starting to like mess with their website and saying, look, I need everybody's LinkedIn to actually say the things they do. I started to have a thesis for how I was going to market this company. I was going to market it using transparency, which is exceptionally ironic given what I was later to find. Listen, we're going to tell all these people who are asking to buy our token should have full information about what they're buying because I in my core believe that is right and fair. And I'm also used to Reg D and all sorts of stuff I've had to deal with in my career where you have to be really careful. So, you know, what I got back from Sean, whose name it would turn out later was not Sean. What I got back from Sean was, yes, that all sounds great. Absolutely. And sure, if you want to take Brock off, doesn't matter. We don't care. Oh, and what do you think of this guy, Michael Turpin and his PR company? And I was like, oh, I know that guy from Hollywood. I mean, I don't know. And all of this was happening while I was hearing that we were going to call ourselves something called a utility. Well, I, again, have experience in finance. I was like, I know what a security is, and I know what a utility is, and I understand that you're going to have a token on this system that provides liquidity, I guess. Having said that, I am not going to say this thing is a utility anywhere that has my name on it, because I am not crazy. And the SEC does not like you calling shit a utility that's a security. And if it's a security, there's a whole bunch of things we're going to have to do. And I've done them before and I can lay out for you how it's all going to work. But I am not calling this thing a utility. So that was like a fight for about a month. Sullivan Cromwell, to their, I guess, credit, only sucked about $100,000 out of the company before they finally said, look, we can't give you permission to call this a utility. So eventually they got other lawyers. Those lawyers also said, I think this is a security. Then they got other lawyers. Those lawyers also said it was a security. So I think the fourth set of lawyers, at that point, they gave up. But meanwhile, at that point, I don't know, $10 million had been raised, $15 million. I have no idea. Just an extraordinary amount of money. There were multiple teams building software, including a team in the US that had built NASDAQ software. There was a hardware guy who actually was buying these sort of curved screens that were going to be the screen and then stacking them in some ridiculous way. And they bought a bunch of screens.
Sorry, just to pause you there. So they raised 10 or 15 million from a venture capital, or who was this raised from?
It was unclear to me. DNA was involved in the first part. The actual ICO didn't really happen until maybe the third month I was there. The ICO was done in the correct way insofar as that is actually a thing, right? So at some point that ICO went out into the world. I had promoted that ICO in what I thought was the safest way possible, the most legal way possible, often getting pushback from the team, but always saying, you hired me, fire me if you don't want to do it this way. This all speaks to something really interesting about the particular way that this would later turn out to be a scam. A lot of people talk about Ponzi schemes. The thing about a Ponzi scheme that is really, really important is that there never is a thing. There can't actually be a thing, or it's not a Ponzi scheme. It's just a scam. This was a scam, not a Ponzi scheme. Why do I say that? Because there was, in fact, software development developing something that was the thing they said they were developing. There was, in fact, hardware that was being purchased, and there was a relationship with FactSet. All of that stuff was real. It's just, it was, and now I am making things up, so grain of salt, it was $3 million worth of the spend of the $30 million that was ultimately raised. The rest was allegedly stolen. So this is a different kind of thing. It's like you could, at the end of it, have possibly come up with, and people tried, like, hey, there's sort of like a screen that sort of works and has these widgets on it, and you could. It wasn't a complete sham. So I was a part of something that at least on some level seemed real. And of course, since I'm in marketing, I'm always one level removed and one layer of bullshit on top of whatever's actually happening. So with all that said, you know, the money that was paying my company, that was mostly pre-ICO. And I think, again, that came from various syndicates. There was a Korean syndicate that put maybe, I don't know, $8 or $10 million in just to back people up on syndicates. You know, what a syndicate really was it was like one rich guy telling all his not as rich friends, give me some money, I'll make you more. We had several. We had Korean, South Korean syndicates. We had Australian syndicates who may have been a front for Chinese money or not. I don't know, but it sort of felt like that. So that was the money that was fueling a lot of this. And ultimately, we were in offices in Midtown with a bank. Those guys may have put money in too. I'm not sure. So I don't want to name them because I'm actually not sure what their relationship was. I had space in my studio where I do content and podcast recording and all this stuff. I had extra space. They rented that space. So they actually moved into my offices. So they came into my offices. Sean, he had come from a company called Estee Hoover. And I didn't really dig into Estee Hoover enough, again, in retrospect, red flag number 15 at this point. Anyway, Estee Hoover was like a public relations firm in Newport Beach, California. A lot of the people who I was working with, it turned out, were from Estee Hoover. I don't know what Estee Hoover is, and I could never exactly figure it out, but it's not good. Several of the people who were part of the Estee Hoover team are have either been indicted or are currently, I believe, incarcerated. So Estee Hoover was, oddly enough, it turned out like at the core of this, it was like the seed of all this. It would later turn out that Sean had used it in various ways to do various of his scams. I started to become skeptical after the ICO. It was very poorly handled. I continued to push back on some of the names, like there were running jokes about the names of advisors we would put on the website. I would then hunt down information about them and say, you can't have that person as an advisor. For I kept saying to them, you're trying to get institutional investors and traders to come onto your platform. These people that you're putting on your advisory board are not impressive to those people. So generally, you know, at this point, the lean was against getting involved in crypto on Wall Street. You know, there was interest, but I think the interest was arm's length interest still at that point. Obviously, things have changed between 2018 and 2021 for various reasons. So I was always trying to keep things for them on the straight and narrow. And as the pushback became stronger and stronger, and as the ICO started to fall apart, I started to do more digging. And so did a colleague of mine, a guy named Gabriel Ortiz, who's like a really great, he's a software programmer and just general all around smart guy. I became friends with Gabriel. Gabriel really, he was bringing in a whale. And this whale, who I think I have to leave his name out of this because he didn't ultimately get involved, but this whale said to Gabriel, are you sure? And Gabriel was like, you know what? Actually, no, I'm not sure. Let me do some digging. And over the course of the summer 2018, Gabriel did a lot of digging and ultimately at the end of the summer discovered that Sean McDonald's real name was Boas Menor and that Boas Menor had run the biggest hedge fund scam in the history of Canada. Essentially, it was about 800 million Canadian that had been scammed in one way or another. There were some diamonds that were involved. Those diamonds had disappeared along with Boaz's sister to Hong Kong. It has been alleged that the money that launched BCT may have come from those diamonds being sold. I don't know that as a fact. I can tell you that the day that I discovered this fact that Sean McDonald was Boas Menor, I had one of those moments where you just scream, fuck, as loud as you can. Pigeons go flying out of the square. I immediately went to Boaz and said, please, sir, if you could get you and your fucking asshole company out of my space, I'd really appreciate it. No need to pay the rent. Meanwhile, at that point, my company was owed a lot of money by BCT. I had gone from pay up front to like net 30, which greater fool me. I had always insisted on getting paid like a regular rate. I gave them hour breakdown for every single employee I had. I ran it as absolutely legitimately as possible because on a certain level, I was like, look, if this turns out to be funky, I want to be prepared when the SEC or the DOJ or the FBI or any other three-letter organization, someone comes knocking at my door, I'm going to say, here are the legal procedures I followed. Here's what I did. I want to take a step back though and talk about an aspect of marketing in crypto versus marketing in not crypto that I think is really potentially, you know, useful for some people to think about, and PR as well in both. The prevalence in crypto of pay to play was one of the most destructive aspects of what happened in 2017, 2018, and a significant reason why a lot of people lost a lot of money. And when you say someone lost money in crypto, instead of it being like, hey, it was some huge fund that like took a bad position, no, the whole point of crypto was it was Joe and his life savings, because let's call it what it is, right? This is whose money was being stolen. And the reason is because a lot of the influencers in the crypto space are people who you pay and then they promote your product. I can name, for instance, Crypto Crow was one example of somebody who we paid and he said whatever shit we asked him to say. There were entire companies that I hired who specialized in nothing but pumping this bullshit. And it had a real effect. In the traditional marketing space, there are rules about everything, every claim you make, especially in finance. I just finished a job with a very significant financial services company here in New York where we did their website. Every single claim we made, every single line we wrote went through compliance because compliance is like, no, that's pushing it too close to the edge. We don't want to say that we're great at that. That's what I'm used to. In crypto, the correction just went completely off the rails and it's insane and it's bad. And a lot of it still goes on. And I think it's just wrong. It's like morally wrong. It's ethically wrong. It needs to be cracked down upon. These influencers are really scum. Like I've become a fan, and this is partially out of following you guys, of CoffeeZilla and his YouTube channel. And, you know, you watch some of those videos and man, it is just disgusting. People just promoting lies to make a short-term gain and at the expense of other people. You know, the thing about the greater fool theory, it puts a lot of onus on the fool being foolish instead of saying like, hey, I'm a marketing person. I successfully lied to that person such that they would lose their money. Because that's really another layer of it. It's not just like I randomly, a fool, gave some money to some people. It's like, oh my God, I heard about this amazing thing from these cool people and there was a Zazzy animation and it was all great. It sounds amazing. Here's the $10,000 I was going to put as a down payment on my house.
I still have some questions. And I mean, I agree with all of what you've said so far. So like you're talking about how the providence of the money could have essentially come from like stolen diamonds. And I'm wondering if like the way they were paying people was through like a Hong Kong bank account, or was it like just a Venmo Hong Kong version or in cash, or like how was this money moving? I'm just like, I'm still trying to understand.
That is an excellent question. So I was being paid monthly, as were a lot of other people. There was a guy who is one of the guys who is at least been indicted on a lot of things, a guy named Asif. I'm forgetting Asif's last name. He was writing checks. No, wire transfers. Sorry, it was wire transfers. I was getting wire transfers of cash. And, you know, again, it was against a contract. I had, a 6-month contract with them or something, and it was the appropriate amount. Now, I think they were offering people crypto as well or their own coin, and they were doing a lot of converting. There was a lot of like cash coming in, being converted into ETH. There was a crash right when they did that. And I don't know, there were a lot of financial machinations going on, which I didn't understand. And again, I tried to keep it really simple. I was like, I charge this much per month. At the beginning of the month, you deposit this much via wire. I think it was an ACH actually into my company's account. It was my company's account, not mine. I paid all my people. There were definitely a lot of shady characters floating around, like both on the hedge fund side, on the I don't really know what you do side, like who are you and what do? You just seem to be around for the money. And then there were some people who I think were legitimately curious and wanted to see what was really happening. And this was like you had a front, you know, front row seat. There were people involved in this who were taking some combination of amphetamines, Viagra, like the shit that was going on. There was like love triangles involved, and it was all around money, right? There was just so much money flowing in and so many people. You know, there was a woman named Christina Page who also, I think, was indicted, alleged. She was involved in a lot of crazy stuff, and she's not a Bitcoin person, but she had come to it. I think she was in real estate. I actually was initially hired by a marketing person named Venezia Rose, who did have a profile on LinkedIn, but her first name is not Venezia and her last name is not Rose. But, you know, in terms of how the money manifested before I started, I can only speculate. It seemed like there was plenty of money to go around by the time I got there. And after the ICO, I assumed that somewhere there was a bank account with all this money in it.
Yeah, and this isn't, it's not something most people would think about, I think. Like, if you're getting a job from someone, you're not like, tell me where that money came from. Like, it's not something someone would normally do. So I'm not expecting you to know exactly that answer. I was just trying to understand a little bit better. Sorry.
But it's also a fair, I think, in retrospect, and even at the time, when Amex hires you, like I did a bunch of stuff for Amex Open Forum. When they hire you, it's like a very standard cut and dry process. You go through their contract process. You like agree to everything because you don't have a choice. They pay you what they pay you in the way they pay you. And it's not, you don't think like, where does Amex get the money? But when it's some randoms and it's a lot of money, you're like, that is a lot of money. How is this working exactly? And like DNA, you know, showed up. I think the actual apex of the ICO moment was there was a crypto conference in New York in, I don't know, I want to say April or May maybe of 2018. And it was just insane. It was tens of thousands of people going through a conference center in Midtown. And DNA had like the top two floors of the hotel. And like, it raised questions. I definitely had questions. But until you believe the greater fool theory of all of this, it's just like, hey, all these people are bringing their money into this new space. And again, as somebody leaning in on the whole democratizing finance, I wanted to believe that that was a good thing.
One of the things you mentioned earlier that I want to ask about before we move on is you said it was difficult for them to travel conventionally. What did you mean when you said that?
Well, okay, there's the core thing, which is like, why is Sean driving to Florida to take a boat to Puerto Rico? Seems like maybe he should fly. So that was one. But then also, I have a lot of really good travel agencies I've worked with. We hired a really good one, an expensive one. I was like, look, this sounds crazy. I need someone who can really like get all these plane tickets and whatever. And as soon as we realized like getting people's, like getting the money lined up the right way, it just seemed complicated. And like, where was the money coming from? Finally, I said to them, look, you just have to put a shitload of money into this travel agency's account and they'll draw down. Like, that's it. I don't understand what all these issues are or why, but so that's what we did. It was a lot of throughput and it was a lot of brain damage as well. And it was 24 hours. The other thing is we were working 24 hours a day because there was a conference going on in Singapore. There was a fundraise going on in Australia. The Koreans would call at 3 a.m. Like, it was all madness.
And you also mentioned Bob Bonomo, who was the president of BCT, and how that helped lend it an air of legitimacy and helped partially convince you this was a thing worth joining. Did you ever have any interactions with him after you started at the company?
Yeah, quite a few. You know, I interviewed Bob. You know, I wanted to trade on his reputation the same as they did. I had a different reason, I thought, because legitimately that was a good thing to do as opposed to because they were stealing Bob's reputation. And Bob, I feel extremely strongly, was not involved in any of the shady stuff. I think Bob was just, he was a stooge, unfortunately, and maybe I'm being unfair to him, but I think that's how it sort of rolled out.
Well, I was going to actually ask you after that. There's a quote from Bob after this all sort of blew up where he said, the president title was in name only. I had no exposure to and no decision-making authority for the management of any of the company's finances, internal operations, or personnel. And so I was just curious if that was consistent with your experience when you were there at BCT.
I was assiduously careful not to be able to know whether or not any of that stuff was true. You know, the offices were like a full floor of a Manhattan, like a 5,000 square foot Manhattan space. My offices were in front. I did not leave them to go into the other offices where Bob was working, where Sean was working, where money was happening, where calls were happening with investors. I would not enter those rooms. Sean Boaz asked me a couple times to come into those meetings. I was like, nope, no f-ing chance. I am not going to get involved in raising a penny for this company in anything except exactly what I do, which is marketing that runs through legal. I had a big sign on the wall that said everything runs through legal that all my employees had to look at every morning. I'll give Bob the benefit of the doubt because I like Bob and he seems like a really solid person to me. You know, Bob somewhat famously is a guy who saved maybe 200 people on 9/11. Bob gets a lot of like life credit, in my opinion. The quote that you read me is definitely very well lawyered.
Out of curiosity, you did see like a functioning version of like the blockchain terminal working in some manner, right? Because of like the 30 or so hedge funds or whatever who were beta testers for this, many of them reported receiving the unit in their office and it just sitting there for months with them waiting for someone from BCT to come like set it up and actually allow them to use it. And so like there were very few people who actually reported like using it in the wild.
And, you know, there were people who were using it in the wild. My company filmed them. I'm not sure how wild they were versus how much they might not have been a part of what was going on. And again, I can only speculate and alleged. I don't know. Actual hedge funds out in the world. Yeah. As far as I know, none of them actually were using it. And then there was the whole FactSet thing, which really, even more than Bob, you know, FactSet is as legitimate as you can get on Wall Street. And in my opinion, what FactSet did, which was essentially sell their name to this company, it turned out in retrospect, I thought that FactSet was actually a partner with BCT, not like BCT had paid FactSet for their name, which they did. And then I started to realize that when FactSet would send software engineers over to meet with our software engineers to come up with a way for it to actually work together. But like they did, you know, one meeting every 2 months and they didn't seem to be taking it seriously. Meanwhile, I was saying FactSet all over the place because we had a contract with them that said I could. You know, I think that speaks to a certain amount of bad behavior on their part, in my opinion.
So what's the, we haven't really gotten to, how did this unwind? What's the unraveling story here?
Well, okay, so we discover, Gabriel in particular, and another guy at the company, discover that Sean is Boaz. Gabriel and I wasted no time. We were like, we're blowing this up right now, today. There were a lot of people there who still wanted to move forward. DNA at that part, I think, was falling apart as well. The ICO market was falling apart generally, right? By September 2018, I just think that it was a very different, you know, there wasn't as much money and there wasn't as much blood in the water, basically. So it was a lot easier to sort of crack down on this. I kicked them out of my offices. They left like 2 days later. Boaz disappeared, never to be seen again. I think he's on the run right now. He's never been arrested. He has been indicted. And yeah, the other folk who were there, a lot of them were still trying to get money out. They were just trying to figure out how to get their money out. I immediately knew I wasn't going to get paid what I was owed and that I was out. My company was out, I don't know, six figures. And it sucked. And I paid out everybody who'd worked for me because I don't like to leave, you know, people who are doing the grind hanging. But I was left hanging. But that's life. You know, I got involved in something that I shouldn't have got involved in. I should have known better. I, at least on some level, blame myself for that. The unraveling beyond that, they left. They left like hard drives. They left all the evidence in my offices just sitting there. So when I got a call from some three-letter agency, I was like, yeah, whatever you need. I'm dropping off a few boxes. Bye now. Once it was clear to said three-letter agency that I was not involved in the scam part, they were like, great, thanks. Where I blame myself is I should have known better, not that I actually did the bad thing in and of itself. However, you know, the way that one marketed in the space is bad, as I said before. And I think it should be criminal, and it's not something I would ever do again. I've been headhunted for a couple of very big jobs in the space, and I give a very stock response, which is, yeah, I'm great at this. If you want to work with me, every single thing that this company says about itself will go through my group, all comms, and it will always be completely transparent, and that transparency will be like fascistic. Like there's no space for bullshit. And I guess where I have a question for you guys, what is the disconnect between the things that I know both of you know and the fact that every day you can go on the block and read about seven more companies who've raised another $50 million from Peter f***ing Thiel? Like, what are we missing, right? Because we must be missing something, because these smarter people than us in, you know, these VC funds are writing gigantic checks daily to companies that sound exactly like the company sounded in 2017, except minus the word ICO.
I certainly don't think you're wrong, at least not in the spirit of it. There's a subset of crypto venture capitalists who love to invest in token deals because they can, depending on their vesting or lockup period, get liquidity within a matter of weeks or months instead of like the traditional VC cycle where they're waiting years to potentially get liquidity. Plus, they're often buying into these deals at pretty massive discounts, often as high as 90% or even more. And so if the day the coin lists, you're already up 10 times, 1,000%. That's a pretty nice, easy win for you as a VC. And so I think it's structural issues with the way token sales in the United States have ended up, and where the original goal was to democratize it and open it up to the average investor. What's ended up happening is a small select group of well-connected venture capitalists and the like have access to these huge pre-sale discounts that basically makes it extraordinarily hard for them to lose money on these investments. So they're willing to write basically any size check they can.
And I don't even think the incentives stop there. I think it's similar to any VC's incentive structure where they have the capital, they can invest in 1,000 shitcoins, and if one of them strikes gold, then they're fine. Like, they'll still make a profit. It doesn't even matter. Whereas if I do that, I will go broke, and I will be wrong on all 1,000 of them.
Yeah, and actually, it's funny. This is very similar to my Hollywood experience. You know, one thing I've always had to explain to the independents when they come in is, look, a studio buys 20 scripts for every one that goes into production. They make 10 to 15 movies for every one that makes it into a theater. And, you know, for every one they put out, maybe 1 out of 5 makes any money. How is that possible that it works? Well, the one that makes money makes a lot of money. And then there's all this ancillary revenue and downstream revenue and stuff that's great. You as an indie, good luck. Like, if you are not spread across a whole bunch of IP, you're really going to struggle in Hollywood. And I think there is, yes, I think you're right, Kaz, there's a similar sort of ability for these guys to spread themselves out. But I guess the thing that I can't fathom, I started to wonder I did more explainer videos, not just for BCT, but for other companies. And like some very nice people, and they would bring me their idea. Like there was an alternative investments one we did. There was a wallet one we did. And it all seemed fine, but I just couldn't wrap my head around, like, but really, though, is this a product? Are you sure? Separate from, is this a product that needs a token? Which, as we know, the answer 150% of the time is no. But is it a product? I had a back and forth with Mark Cuban maybe a month and a half ago on Twitter. I said he was promoting whatever shitcoin he promoted a couple months ago disastrously. And I was like, Mark, just tell me what product, exact product that exists in the world today is better because of blockchain and Bitcoin. And he listed categories. And I was like, right, sure. Payment, you know, remittance, that does sound great, but like, is there a product today that I can use that's better than Western Union or PayPal or Venmo to send someone money?
Nano, what have you heard of Nano or have you heard of XRP?
Ripple and Nano. And it's like, no. Like, none of these things actually, the best is, I'm sure you guys saw it, was that hilarious back and forth on Twitter with the guy who lost the Lightning bet and then tried to get paid in Lightning. I mean, that's one of the
Eric Wall, you're talking about Eric Wall.
Yes, that is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. It's like, no normal person wants, here's what I like to do. I need to give you $20. What's your Venmo? Okay, cool. You got it? Great. Thanks. That was great. Bye. What was the cost of that? It was zero because I did it from my debit card and not my credit card. That seems like a good cost. And like, you can go spend that money and it will be worth $20, not 27 or 13.
One of the examples I can use to counter that, just to give a little balance here, is that PayPal's Chinese remittance method for PayPal is called Zoom, XOOM. This is not I'm not doing an advertisement for them. I'm simply suggesting that I've used it before and the fees were extraordinarily high for sending money to China, which on the surface level doesn't seem like that hard a thing to accomplish. What I can't say is that blockchain would make that better and that it would be easier because, like you're talking about, you know, the fees just metamorphosize depending on the time of day and the volume and the...
Hey, it's totally opaque. It costs, if you go on the website, it's $300. If you go on Travelocity, it's $250. And if you call them, it's $350. And you'll never know why. Also, that was true at 4. It's 5. None of that's true anymore. Like, okay, what, you're replicating that. But to take a step back to what BCT was doing that I think was a fundamental flaw that is interesting about bringing a certain naivete into an existing business. I think both you guys will understand this quite well. The thing about a lot of day trading and a lot of trading, especially margin trading, is that it is the antithesis of digital. It is completely analog in the sense that, like, if you're taking a short position on something and you need 100,000 shares of whatever, probably you're never going to actually get those 100,000 shares in any way that would make any sense on a ledger. What are you going to do? Somebody else has them, you're borrowing it from them, but are you really borrowing 100,000 shares? Were 100,000 shares ever really transferred to you in any way that would constitute ownership as any of us normal people would understand it? Not really. Like, it's a lot of like, hey, bud, you know me, I know you, I need those 100,000 shares, cool, I sort of have them, I think, at this price, great, this is the, I have 30 days, whatever. I would say to these guys at Blockchain Terminal, when, you know, I was dealing with them, I'd be like, guys, you know, most traders don't actually want any of that on an immutable ledger, because I'm not sure that there are 100,000 shares, but there's a position they're really confident in and they want to take it, and they don't want to be stuck in like, wait, I actually have to find all these things. I actually have to make sure that they all exist exactly the way we said. And there's absolute proof of it all the way. That's just not, it's like counterintuitive to a lot of people about Wall Street, but a lot of Wall Street is done on like a wink and a nod. But that's part of like the lubrication of the whole system. The whole system, as soon as you take that away and say, no, I want every single thing to be accounted for exactly appropriately for every moment, always, the system kind of falls apart on Wall Street. And I'm not defending it, or I'm not making a qualitative judgment about this. I'm just saying, like, my experience of it is, if you come in and say, no, from now on, every single thing you do, we're going to have absolute proof and you're not going to be able to back out of it or whatever, it might notionally improve the fairness of Wall Street, but it would bring it to a halt.
Well, I think it's an interesting point you're making, because I've spoken to Craig Sellers in Twitter threads, essentially. And I think he genuinely believes that the blockchain is a better method because it is more transparent than the functional financial system. And I hear that, but I keep suggesting, whether we're talking about charities or we're talking about a general partnership or a giant corporation, it's the last mile problem. It doesn't matter if most of this is immutably on the blockchain. Like, at the end of the day, you still are going to settle in US dollars, or, you know, you're going to need to buy electricity and server space from somewhere using some form of fiat currency, likely. And you don't solve that with a blockchain. You cannot solve that with a blockchain.
Not yet. You can in a maximalist's or a utopianist view of it. You're like, yeah, but someday. It's like, okay, but really? This is another, I think, really important point that gets to the value of Bitcoin. If you don't go as far as like Stephen Diel is going, okay, and he may be right and he seems like a brilliant guy, but like, set aside his own vision of like, it's all worth nothing. Let's say it is worth there's some reasonable way to actually account for the value of Bitcoin. What I do not see from either the altcoin people or Bitcoin people is the negative externalities being properly priced. And it's really frustrating. And the main negative externality is the existence of incumbents and how hard they fight you. And if you don't price that in, you're dumb. If you're telling me like, we're gonna take out the US dollar, I'm like, okay. So here are the things between you and that: the Fed, the Pentagon, and the world economy. So have you priced that into your fantasy? Because it will be very expensive to take out those three entities. You may do it. I'm not saying you're incapable. I'm just saying, like, if you were a revolutionary in 1774 and you were like, listen, we're just going to have a country, and you weren't like, oh, we're going to have to fight the British, though, people would be like, you seem very dumb. I went through this in Hollywood in the late 90s and early 2000s, where all these like Web 1.0 guys who'd made hundreds of millions of dollars came out to Hollywood, and they were like, you know, I've looked at film budgets and they're like inflated by 20 to 40%, and we can just cut the fat out and it's going to be great. And I would say, like, yeah, look up in the hills. You see all those lights up there? Those are like people's houses and like mortgages. And you know what pays for them? The 20 to 40% you're talking about. So as long as you price in fighting all of those people and telling them they shouldn't have that money anymore, maybe you're right. Maybe it'll happen. In some industries, it has. Photography has been completely, you know, destroyed basically as a financial, you know, way to make money by some of these changes. It can happen. It just won't happen for free. And if you don't price it in, you're bad at thinking.
This actually segues great into the question I was preparing to ask, which is that in the cryptocurrency space, for me at least, it can be extraordinarily difficult to differentiate between these companies, these protocols, and these coins that are raising money. Which ones are just flat-out scams, and which ones are just run by naive utopians? Because many of them seem to promise the unbelievable, but the people involved do seem to honestly believe it. And so I always really struggle with how to interact and deal with that kind of project. Like, where you have people trying to break into industries they seem to not know the first thing about. And in some ways, that's kind of what the story of Blockchain Terminal looked like to me, where they had certain hedge fund people like Bob involved, but they weren't actually really connected to the process or to the day-to-day of actually creating a product for that industry. And so what instead you had was like a group of naive utopians led by a charismatic criminal who basically was taking advantage of all these other people involved. And it just seems to be such a common theme over so many of these cryptocurrency projects.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent, honestly, like a perfect summation of it. And the charismatic, Sean Boaz did have a tremendous amount of charisma. He did have a great sales patois. I really want to go back to the first point you made, because I think it's really interesting, like, how does one differentiate? And I think there's a third category, which I think, Kaz, maybe you described earlier, of people who are just profit-taking. When someone says to me, like, Rob, how come all of a sudden some of these institutions have gotten it? I'd be like, because there's enough money for them to take now. That's it. JP Morgan doesn't give a fuck. We're here because we can make money, and we will make money. And because we're JP Morgan or whomever, we'll make more money probably than other people because we're better at this. We're smarter. We have better supercomputers. Like, we're just better at it. And you know what? They are. They just, that's what they do. They make money for a living. And I live in New York City and my kids go to a fancy private school. And I know some of those people and they make a lot of money, unimaginable amounts of money, because they're so damn good at it.
Yeah. And like, even some of the crypto market makers and stuff have acknowledged this, like DRW and Cumberland Mining basically said they were able to use tactics that made them money in crypto that hadn't been effective in traditional finance markets for years, because in the traditional finance markets, there were other people trying to do the same thing. And whatever advantage it was had basically been eliminated from the market because everyone knew about it. But the crypto markets were so much more naive that they were able to run the stops and take advantage of these market structure things because it was so often run by these people who weren't familiar with those types of financial actors and what they'll do to make their money.
Yeah, just always remember there's a counterparty, and that counterparty, if someone go up, someone go down. It's not like the heist movie where it's like, don't worry about the money, it's insured. It's like, don't worry about the money, it's other people's money that they might need, but they don't get to have it anymore, and you who already have a lot get to have more. That's most of what's happening in the transfer of wealth in this system, unfortunately. And you know, I mentioned this to you guys before we started, but I came at this from a very traditional left kind of perspective around equity, egalitarianism, fairness. I believe all those things. I was raised that way. It's who I am. It's what my politics are. And I wanted that to be true. I leaned as hard into that as I could. And I'm not a cyber libertarian. I don't believe in any of that nonsense. I never have. Unfortunately, it's immaterial if you have a left perspective on this, a right perspective, a cyber libertarian perspective. The only perspective you need to have is, people who are really good at extracting wealth from systems are going to extract wealth from this system. And those people are the exact same people they've always been. And nothing has changed. The Winklevosses are not like manning, you know, the gates at the revolution. They're rich guys. There's, you know, we don't have time for it in this conversation, but I have all sorts of issues with the way Wall Street operates, the way front running operates, the way high frequency trading operates. I think it's all like awful. Like, you guys making a podcast and then hopefully charging people for it. That's like a thing. You're doing a thing. You're adding content. You're creating something potentially of value, and hopefully people are paying for it. I believe in that. I'm into that. I don't really care about people figuring out a way to arbitrage a millisecond of information. Like, that's what I really believe in. And I thought maybe ICOs and generally all of this stuff could be a mechanism to make something like that happen. And unfortunately, I feel like the opposite has happened. And separate from criminality, separate from the, you know, bad actors, good actors, naivete, that's the part that I'm really like most disappointed in.
I just wonder, like, you've been in marketing for a long time. You've been doing this for a while. You've worked with a lot of I assume a lot of great people and a lot of probably not so great people too. What was your main lesson learned from working on Blockchain Terminal, from working with these people? When you walked away at the end of the day, like, what do you reflect on the most about it?
I thought most about the way people respond to incentives. Like, I'd never seen it so clear to me that if you just wave like a money spigot, people are going to come running, good and bad. And, you know, I've had a career of ups and downs, especially financially. Like, it's part of being in the Hollywood game. It's just like, that's the way it goes. You have good years and bad years. And I've always tried to keep an even keel through all of it. I've always tried to give that advice to other people as well. Like, don't, it's not about not buying the Lambo. It's about not turning into an asshole when money arrives. And, you know, I did see a lot of people who maybe are decent people turn into the moment money was waved at them in this. And for me, it was just a reminder that, you know, money can't be your God. It is ironic that Bitcoin maximalists and generally people who are into Bitcoin often come off as feeling like it is their God. And I just think people really need to take a step way the fuck back and think about, like, how have you made money so important to your existence? Like, and that was just... There were plenty of people at BCT who, if I had met them under different circumstances, I'm sure I would have liked them. I would have thought they were great people, kind, interesting, smart, who instead I just saw as like greedy lunatics scrapping to get the most they could extract out of a situation that they probably knew in retrospect was not good.
Thank you for coming on, Robert. That was fantastic.
If you want to let people know where to find you on Twitter or something like that.
I'm at... Robo Green, R-O-B-O-G-R-E-E-N. If you care too much about cycling in New York City, bog standard left-wing politics, or crypto skepticism, then mine is the Twitter handle to follow.
It was wonderful to have you on today. This was a great conversation.